Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Ilona Thompson, Palate Exposure. I'm here with Tim McDonald, who actually has probably forgotten more than most of us will ever know. 3 decades in the industry, he founded a company, a marketing and communication company that's called Wine Spoken Here, that's been in existence for 12 years. And we're going to get to know him personally and professionally. Very excited about that. So Tim, let's just get some basic details, like where were you born, how did you come to be?
Thanks, Ilona. I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada, and my dad was a stagehand, and that's where we ended up because there was theater work there for people running spotlights, etc., building sets. And I grew up wanting to figure out this eating, and mostly about eating and drinking. So my first job was at the Stardust Hotel. I worked as a waiter in the Palm Room, which was their coffee shop, a 3-meal-a-day place that was a lot of fun and kind of cut your teeth on it. We got lucky and got promoted to the steakhouse there. I had a pal of mine, Gilbert Martin, who was also very interested in wine and food, and so my pal and I would work same shifts, same places, and then we got promoted to where the Lido de Paris was, and the dinner shows. And there was a time that you went to a dinner show, and then there was the midnight show where there were only cocktails. And so we very much enjoyed the experience of working, waiting on tables. And sometimes people even say, "So, well, that must have been really interesting. Made a lot of money." I said, "We did it. We made pretty good money, but you know, Visa and MasterCard hadn't been invented yet, so we were very fortunate that the cash was king." And then I went to UNLV, although I changed my major to hotel. I started in communications, and just enjoyed hotel management and restaurant management and being around the 3 restaurants that I had worked there. And in about 1976 or so, I got to work with another friend that I'd met at the Tillerman restaurant. We invented our version of surf and turf with the salad bar brought to the table. And eventually, I got back into the hotel space and worked at the Flamingo Hilton for a bit, and at some point I was just wanting to move to where there was water, like the ocean, for example. You grow up in the desert, so I left before the big boom that you see today.
Okay.
And got a job over in Honolulu as a assistant room service manager at the Hilton Hawaiian Village. And then had a couple restaurant jobs, managed a couple of restaurants. Opened the Blue Water Cafe on Kuhio, which was the first country and western breakfast, lunch, and dinner place in Waikiki. And then during a short period of, helped open the Honolulu Club too.
Wow.
Which is over by Blaisdell. So I enjoyed both the customer side of it, but I also liked the managing side of it. And at one point, the economy really went south in Honolulu because of tourism. And I ended up unemployed and got a job with McKesson Wine and Spirits as a salesman, working the Waikiki and eventually the military market there in Oahu. And that was a blast because suddenly I wasn't working at night. I wasn't waiting on clients, whether it was cocktail, you know, serving food. I had to get up in the morning and call on accounts. And We used to run our territories. The cutoff time was around noon. No one had any form of communications. You carry change in your pockets to make some phone calls and call in your orders for delivery. And then when you were done at cutoff time, which was generally around noon, then you could go hit up and go call in restaurants for not for Tuesday delivery, but for Wednesday. So I had the ABC chain, which was fun. It's a collection of convenience stores, of which there are dozens of them in Waikiki, and had to keep the shelves stocked. And then I spent the afternoons and evenings looking after my restaurant clients. One day, Seagram hired me, and I got to move to San Francisco, 1983. I was the first chain store manager in Northern California for Seagram Distillers, and the most popular whiskey around at that time was Seagram 7. So we were fortunate to call on chains and ultimately got promoted to run the state of Nevada, as well as included in that, oddly enough, was Alaska, and because it was separated by control states. So I did that for a year, and then got to move and get promoted one more time, one final time with Seagram, where I was in national accounts calling on headquarters of restaurant chains and hotel groups like Hyatt Hotels, Radisson Hotels, etc., Stouffer, and a few restaurant chains that were popular back then.
That was a big job.
Yeah, it really was. It was my first corporate position where, you know, you really had to sell an entire portfolio. And Seagram used to have, well, they certainly were a large wine outfit back then. Seagram is thought of as being mostly spirits, but in fact, they owned Palmasan. They had Champagne Mum. They built Mum Champagne here in Napa, and they had a lot of agency brands that they looked after for other people, as well as they were an importer of Barton and Guestier, plus they're most known in wine circles for Chateau and Estates, where they had plenty of Bordeaux, some Spanish producers, very much a European portfolio. I think at one point I wanted to get back to California, so or the West Coast, shall we say. And after 5 years, I came back here. Got a temporary job with Jalco, which was a distributor, again, calling on chains. And my mentor and boss at the time was David Gainza, who's still with Southern Glaziers here in Northern California. Although I think they call the department American Wine. And Hubline hired me, and again, I'm calling on national account chains here in the West Coast, a little bit different, but a lot of fun. And there's nothing like calling on a Westin Hotel headquarter or an El Torito headquarter or a Stuart Anderson's, because when you got the order, it was generally for a long time, and it was consistent and reliable. So if you called on big chains, you could be a hero. A interesting juncture with Hubline, which is basically Diageo. Seagram, same thing, basically Diageo, although with the mergers and acquisitions the last several years, Hubline was also a very big wine player with the Beaulieu Vineyard. They at some point there had Christian Brothers Wine and Inglenook, and represented other wine labels in the import side, including Lungarotte, Mastro Berardino, Ceretto, La Doucette, just a pretty nice portfolio of both wines and spirits. Known in their spirits for Smirnoff and Cuervo and a few things like that. And that was a very pleasant to move when I was about 40 into the PR role, because they had purchased Glen Ellen from the Benzinger family. I ended up doing my best to learn and practice how to be a good communicator within the wine space. The internet hadn't been birthed yet, and we had newspaper journalists, and we had magazines, and we had the role of pitching brands for fits, for mm-hmm. them to fit. And Food and Wine magazine was just getting started, and you know, the internet didn't exist yet, so all of our influencers were basically out of a newspaper column, whether it would be in San Francisco, LA, Seattle, Portland, etc. And there was, at that time, probably a couple of hundred wine writers that were either doing weekly contributions, uh-huh. and then some of them did feature stories, because that's what they did. They might have been in a magazine that came out quarterly, or bi-monthly, or like as in the Wine Spectator, every month. Wine Enthusiasts got invented later in the 80s. And frankly, we have, fast forward to today, the internet became a very popular way of communicating with people. And today you still have newspapers and magazines, of course, and newsletters, the most known being the Wine Advocate. Mm-hmm. And in its time, it was pretty much the bee's knees, and people that were selling brands of wines or wineries that were new, let's say. There was nothing like getting a review from Parker and the Wine Advocate. It was kind of like being a comedian and being on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
You arrive. And after you learn to meet all these individuals and help them and be a, what's that, like be a...
in a mentor role?
Well, more of a, you know, be a resource. Okay. You know, be someone who can, you know what they like. Mm-hmm. You know, and some of them had high-end sort of columns. Mm-hmm. Some of them had very affordable wines as their beat, shall we say. And in the early 90s, that all kind of evolved into what you see the version of it today, where people were, their journalistic endeavors and stories were what was known as blogging. And, you know, the year 2000 probably was right when it started to pivot and be very important to get behind the influencers and the people who had a voice and they were writing good stories about certain topics. And, I always thought, geez, the nice thing about it is it always changes. And that's one of the things I really love about wine business and wine branding, and how do you make things emotionally connect with consumers. One of those ways, and I believe it's the strongest way, is people writing about your wine in a manner that's positive. Whether you're fortunate enough to get your bottle on the Today Show with someone like Leslie Sobrocco, or you're lucky enough that it's liked so much by all the critics that the scores tend to be in the 90 plus range. So we know that the way to move through vintage is third party recommendations, people like yourself that have thousands of people following you. Even magazines, which are, I think, on the decline. However, they all exist online too. So if you share things with people, the more people you share them with, the more likely it is that someone might find your wine. And today you can find it on your phone by just going to wine.com and ordering something, because they stock 34,000 labels of wines. Or you can do like I like, is going to, you know, local wine shops and, you know, accounts. I like chains too somewhat, because they have such a nice collection. And those tags that say recommended by so and so, or 92 points, and frankly, used to be very, very important who the person was. So, you know, you had this hierarchy of Jim Lowby, Wine Spectator, and Robert Parker, Wine Advocate, and, you know, someone from the Wine Enthusiast, etc. And now you have a lot bigger puzzle of people that recommend wines. So even I remember when Anthony Dias Blue was on at Bon Appetit for a decade or so, and he never used the scoring system. And then when he became a freelance on his own guy, he also wrote newspaper, but he started with a point system. And people that started using points, I think really it really made a difference, because it was a little bit like getting an A, a B. And no one really talked so much about the C's and the D's.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they did A, B, and C. A and B, you got 90 points, you got 89. Depends on the price, you know, depends on the location. And it was back then that I started judging, too. So when Westin Hotel was one of my primary national account clients, Kurt Fisher, the corporate food and beverage, used to gather about 15 people to taste with their F&B types, a couple master sommeliers, some suppliers, of which I was one, a mm-hmm. representative. And that's where I kind of figured out that, you know, if you took two or three or four persons and put them in a panel, and they had to taste Chardonnay, or they had to taste Cabernet Merlot, whatever it might be, that you would have a group sort of effort of the conclusion, you know. And in our case, here in the modern age, we use the terminology gold medal, mm-hmm. which oftentimes means that if the panel was four persons, at least two of them said gold. Mm-hmm. And the consensus voting is kind of a nice way to come up with good value. And if those brands are available, they get to be put on a hotel list or a restaurant list. And that became a pretty typical way, I think, of determining why a restaurant group or why a hotel group would carry something. Not unlike what does a consumer do when they're affected, let's say, by volunteering at those events or by following the results of the California State Fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a state fair, but all of the folks that run it have in the past done, I think, a fairly good job of making sure that the cream rises to the top. All competitions that I've judged at, hundreds of them, they're always blind. We don't know much at all other than the category it's in. So we don't know AVAs, we don't know, you know, alcohols, let's say, et cetera. And it's just become a standard here in the U.S., not unlike it is a standard in Australia, New Zealand, and to some extent certain markets in Europe. So you got the old world, new world, and the new world is definitely likes a competition. Not unlike when you submit wines to a magazine, that reviewer editor that covers that area is going to taste a few hundred wines over a period of a few days and come up with the Cabernet report, the Chardonnay report. And I always think that for me, one of my roles is to tell the story in front of someone, but also make sure that they enter these wines and wine judgings, that they get the submissions to the various key writers, that's how they review wines, whether it's Galone in today's age,
yeah,
or whether it's you know, somebody you know, just has a judging, and one of the things they provide are numbers. So in addition to a gold medal, maybe you get a 92. Does the 92 compare to this one over here? Doesn't matter. It's a 92 that they can then share with the customer, and maybe they'll touch their bottle and put it in their grocery cart, so to speak. So labels are important, names are important, price points important, to a degree categories and AVAs are important, but having a third party endorsement is pretty much what Wine Spoken Here does. I work with Rusty Eddy and Robert Larson. We usually have seven or eight clients, sometimes more, sometimes less, and you balance that all out based on a lot of new vintage. If there's a new vintage of something, you kind of have to get right on it. Writers, from my recollection, pretty much like things that are current or just released. We represent, over the years, a fair amount of California wines, maybe mostly Sonoma Napa. But we also have been fortunate to have a lot of Central Coast wines and also Australia and New Zealand. I think I met you when I had Robert Oatley from Australia. He first came back after selling Rosemount to the current owners.
That's accurate, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I just went out to Lodi and saw the Mettler family on Friday, and they have all been talking about putting someone on in PR, and they may not have the volume, shall we say, to have someone as an employee. So PR practitioners are very easy to sign up, I have many, many good, competent people that are friends that do exactly what I do. And you find clients, you mind them, you give them advice, and then you make sure the wines end up in the position of being uncorked.
Yeah.
And then reviewed. And it's an aggregate of all these things today. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's hard, it's just that it's simplest to say one review isn't going to be the home run. Like the old days of non-internet, many reviews are what drive sales, and I feel that that's part of storytelling, is to come up with reasons why you would purchase this fellow's or lady's Chardonnay over this one. And then as you get to learn about family operations and smaller companies that are the mom and dad and the daughters and sons, and you kind of like that. Just like shopping local is cool in many regions because you have local markets. I think we support vintners the same way, that we find somebody we really like and the wines are good and the price is right. And maybe you met the winemaker, and so our job is to make sure that those winemakers emotionally connect with customers.
Yeah.
Or make sure the distributor folks in the middle, who are the real people that make shit happen, they're the ones that have to make sure those bottles get presented to the locations, especially because... Hey, my favorite account to buy Bordeaux is probably Costco, because they always have a great selection of higher-end wines, and the prices are really fair. Yeah. So a different kind of sell than, let's say, going to the bottle shop in your neighborhood. But they all have one thing in common, and that's shelf talkers that help tell the story. If you're lucky, the story gets partially told by the information that's on the label, or the picture that's on the label, or the name. So having a family name is different than a made-up name, how it emotionally connects with you. And if you find out that these folks have been farming their land for a couple of decades or more, using organic or sustainable practices in farming, might not necessarily be owned by a multinational company, but more rooted in the region that we're talking about. And this is very true, I think, of the old world. Mm-hmm. And however, I've always believed it doesn't really matter what tastes good. And if you had someone help you get to that bottle, because there's only 500,000 bottles out there, if someone says, hey, this is worth a stop, and you get $20 whatever the price might be. I don't think wine is a large investment. It's a pleasure that we have for our palate. It has a lot of, I saw someone say, well, what's the right time to drink wine? And I was thinking, well, it isn't the same as spirits, where there's this idea that a cocktail comes at 5 o'clock because that's, you know, cocktail hour. Wine is a food accompaniment, not unlike ketchup and mustard. And we see it consumed, I think, at lunchtime. And we also see it on Sundays if we have brunch. You might be a champagne or a sparkling drinker. You might be taking that same fizz and mixing it with OJ. I hope it's fresh squeezed. Or you might, you know, have a cocktail of some sort. You know, if you're in New Orleans, where the Tales of the Cocktail event just finished up, people will have certain mixed drinks for breakfast.
So for a new brand that has an aspiration to penetrate the market, and it's quite a saturated market, as we talked about, what would be your advice? I mean, you clearly act as a conduit between the source and the end user, or intermediate user, as you described. I heard you say a lot about personalizing and emotional attachment. Is that at the top of the heap for the young brand?
I think when you're new, and there's a lot of new. I mean, when you and I bump into each other at events where the trade is being poured some of very new products that they might not have had before, to get a consumer to buy for the first time something that is relatively new to them, is a the first step. And I remember when Brand New Zealand came on with Cloudy Bay and some of the other notables from New Zealand, and most of this wine was coming from Marlborough, and it didn't taste like our Sauvignon Blanc, whether it was Sonoma, Napa, Temecula, doesn't matter. It was really racy and different, and and then it became, you know, you become part of a buzz. So that new brand kind of got into the limelight in the same way, I think, that even popular priced brands that are new either get embraced by the consumer, or maybe we scratch our heads a little bit. But The Prisoner, for example, when it was Finney's Orange Swift brand new, I mean, they're I think their big strategy was create a label that's nothing like anything else, quite unique. And then luck has it in the same sense that a couple of reviewers that are important really liked it. And it was kind of the first time that somebody took Zinfandel and added two or three other ingredients or grape types. And, you know, we were all varietal-centric, I mean, or region-centric.
Right.
And all of a sudden there were things popping up that were neither. And that new, try and find something that's unique to you. And if you make great wine, then some critic that matters is going to like it.
So again, I'm hearing differentiate yourself from the crowd.
Oh, yes.
You know, stand out for some reason, whether it's the exterior, the aesthetic, or what's in a bottle, or maybe hopefully even both.
Yeah.
But make sure that it's something different, something fresh, something that hasn't been done before.
Yeah, and the reality is that that's one of the things that, just like labels, you know, labels used to always be these white paper things that were shaped in a rectangle or a square. Now, it can be anything. And color is big, and or in the case of Prisoner, a very brooding style of its original format. If you stand for something, I remember when Fetzer first got started in the late 80s and early 90s, they stood for organic and sustainable farming, and also low impact in their bottling procedures. So for a popular price, it really did very well, because there were no other like that in that price point.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.